used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
And the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show, Canada's only radio program on animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM Co-op Radio, CFRO, broadcasting live from unceded Coast Salish territories, also known as Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, February the 15th, 2009. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I am joined here today by our co-host, Sinead Sanders.
Hello.
And Carol Davies McIntosh on the controls.
Hello there.
This past week, I've had the pleasure to read the latest upcoming book by one of my all-time favorite authors and longtime vegan luminary, Dr. Will Tuttle. You might best know of him from his top-selling previous book, The World Peace Diet, which I highly recommend for every human being to read. He has now edited and co-authored a new book called Buddhism and Veganism, Essays Connecting Spiritual Awakening and Animal Liberation. Now, if you're wondering what Buddhism and veganism have to do with each other, well, that's what our feature interview is about today. In reading this book, I discovered the strong interconnections that lie between the fourth largest religion in the world, Buddhism, which has no belief in a personal god, and veganism, a lifestyle which wholly endeavors to do the least harm possible to all living beings. Stay tuned for our feature interview with educator and former Zen Buddhist monk, Dr. Will Tuttle, as he shares his deep wisdom on these topics. That interview is coming up in about 14 minutes, so please do stay tuned for that. Now, last weekend, I spent a whole day on Sunday working to build my skills and understanding of the topics of equity, diversity, and inclusion, and how they are represented or can be better represented in social justice movements such as the animal rights movement. I attended a workshop that was facilitated by a very knowledgeable person named Calamity Hildebrandt, who is the director of research and education at a great community organization called SFPIRG, the Simon Fraser Public Research Interest Group, a social and environmental justice center located at Simon Fraser University. This workshop was customized for members of the vegan advocacy movement in Vancouver, and I wanted to thank especially Megan for inviting me to this workshop and for organizing the event along with Robin, Nadine, and Sammy. Plus, thanks to Calamity for taking so much time and thought in researching and preparing many resources specifically geared towards our vegan advocacy movement. Now, I believe it's community-led educational events like these that can pave the way for progress in social justice movements when it comes to recognizing systems of oppression and privilege as they play out in a social justice culture that ultimately wants to end injustices towards others, but can sometimes be the instigator of an injustice towards other beings ourselves. Now, Sinead and Carol, you weren't in attendance last week at the workshop, but I do hope you can attend a future event like this, as there are plans to put on another one or more in the future. I feel that as animal advocates in our daily lives, and especially here in the radio show, it's important to be mindful, aware, and knowledgeable of the systems of oppression that lie within our culture so that we can be facilitators to act in a way that promotes and respects equity and inclusion. Now, I'm wondering if you could both share what your thoughts are, if you would like, about the animal rights movement, whether either in general or here in Vancouver specifically, and how you see equity, inclusion, and accessibility to either play or not play a role in being part of the movement. Sinead, how about you start first?
All right. Well, generally speaking, I'd say that I've always felt pretty well accepted wherever I've gone, whatever events I've gone to, actions among animal rights activist here in Vancouver. It's easy for me to say as a white person going in with, like, you know, I can't speak to what other people have experienced who have other sorts of things going on in their lives, but I can speak from a disability perspective to some degree. I do have an invisible disability, which is something that sort of further complicates things in a way. I've got a brain injury that basically makes it so it takes me more time and energy to do things that may seem like easy tasks or quick things for other people. So sometimes I feel like I'm expected to do more than I'm able to take on. But as soon as you explain anything, as soon as you set boundaries or anything, then I've really found that there's a pretty good culture of self-care and acceptance in my experience. And of course, physical accessibility is something else, you know, for people with disabilities where they're in a wheelchair, etc. That's not something that I've experienced firsthand, but I have noticed that there are accessibility notes on all the events that I seem to get invited to. You know, people make a point of making these things places that everybody can go and everybody can participate.
Well, I just wanted to share an experience that I had last year at the Animal Liberation Conference, which was held in Berkeley, California, and the organizers were the organizations Direct Action Everywhere, the SAVE Movement, and Anonymous for the Voiceless, and we had over 1,000 people converge from all over the world, really. And the purpose of this event was, it was very mindfully organized to be accessible to, I found, to basically everyone who wanted to come, whether you didn't have any money, people of all abilities, people of all races, people of all genders. And I just found that that was really heartwarming to me, to know that I was part of a community there that was genuinely welcoming everyone to take part. And, you know, I feel that not only do we need all those who are interested in fighting for animal liberation, but animal liberation and human liberation go hand in hand, and to be a completely genuine movement that recognizes and fights against oppression, we have to have compassion and kind consideration for people of all abilities, all sizes, all colors, all ages, and so forth. And I want to thank our friend Elmira Tanner specifically, as she was one of the big organizers of that event, and there's another one coming up soon in a few months. So I really hope to see that this type of social justice community culture will spread among our world. And as you probably know yourselves, all oppressions are interconnected, right? So when others are oppressed, no one can be free. Speciesism is what we're fighting in our movement, right? It's the oppression that we are specifically fighting for in the animal rights movement, but it is so interconnected with environmental issues, such as the pipeline for one, gender oppression, body shaming, which we talked about on a show recently, and classism, just to name some threads of interconnection oppressions. And the way that systemic oppression works is that there is a creation of system oppression imbalances. And this brings me to talk about the importance of intersectionality within the social justice movements. I mean, we only really have a very short time here, but this is definitely an issue to be explored more in the future. But all other movements, such as the feminist movement, the LGBTQIA movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, they're all made of people who are oppressed by society and culture, and I think it's so important and crucial that these social justice movements can bond together. And one way we can do that is by educating ourselves and educating each other on the systems of oppression that cause these movements to exist. Any final thoughts you'd like to share on that, Carol or Sinead?
I think that it doesn't matter where you look, all what you've said is all oppressions are connected, and they absolutely are. We can't free one section of our society or of our world without freeing the rest.
Mm-hmm. And remember to just be accepting of people, except that not everybody is coming from the same place, and some people are coming from different forms of oppression. So when we're talking to people in in the animal rights movement. And, you know, sometimes people feel like there's judgment. There's, you know, you've got to be a perfect vegan if you're going to participate. But there's no such thing as a perfect vegan. It's not about perfection or purity. It's about harm reduction. So don't be... No judgment. You know, we want to get everybody involved here.
And my final takeaway thoughts from this workshop that I took last Sunday was take the time to learn about forms of oppression in our society and in the world. Read the stories of those who are different from you and explore allyship and solidarity.
Did you know that Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, has over 90 different shows produced by over 350 community members? This wide range of programming produced by our diverse group of programmers ensures that we have a show you'll love. We have shows on feminism, spirituality, disability rights, politics, unions, and parenting. We play jazz, indie rock, reggae, blues, and folk. We broadcast in a dozen different languages and have more First Nations programs than any other radio station in Vancouver. Find your show on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM. All different, all the time.
For some events. So in line with what we were just talking about with intersectionality, this Sunday, February 17th, there is an online tofu talk. Tofu, that's all caps. That's from Tofu Magazine. That's based in Halifax. And tofu stands for Totally and Obviously Effed Up, which originally was in reference to factory farming, but the magazine has expanded to really just cover all sorts of oppression issues. So they've been hosting this series of webinars called Tofu Talks, and this Sunday the focus is on fat positivity. So the editor, Ryan Patey, will be talking with Jenny Marie, Andy Tabar, and Chelsea Lincoln of Fat Vegan Voice to discuss fat positivity and the importance of it within the vegan movement and in the world in general. So over roughly an hour, Ryan will ask the guests a series of questions before opening it up to the audience. And this event will be happening through YouTube and Google Hangouts. So that's this Sunday, February 17th, from 11 a.m. until 12:30 p.m. When it starts, you'll be able to join on their YouTube page, youtube.com/tofumagazine. And if you can't watch it live, it'll be posted on that same page for viewing whenever you want. So, yeah, that's great, because as we're talking about, all bodies, everybody is welcome here.
And everyone can attend it,
and everyone,
it's online.
Yeah, everyone can attend because it's online. So you can find more info on that on their website, which is ilovetofu.ca. And really quick here, Allison, did you want to talk about Dog Wab next weekend?
Yeah, I did. This is an event that I've been involved with. This is our sixth one, starting about a year and a half ago on July the 1st. The Day of Giving Within Arbitrary Borders is happening next weekend, and it's organized by just a group of caring human and animal volunteer advocates who believe that no one should be without nourishing food and basic personal care necessities. So next weekend, specifically on February the 24th, we will be making a minimum of 300 delicious plant-based meals to hand out to residents on the downtown east side on Sunday, February the 24th. In addition, we will be setting up our free store, as we call it, and offering many personal care items that we have sourced through donations. Now, this is an all-community run endeavor, and we need community to be on board with however they can to help. We still need some cash donations to help buy bulk materials and eco-focused food packaging, plus some additional items that are not donated. So we're still in need of about $2,000 for that. And there's a link on our Facebook page where you can find out more info about this and how to help. We also need reusable water containers, warm hats and gloves, new undergarment bottoms, disposable razors, combs, brushes, socks, and reusable tote bags. If you would like to learn more, please check out the link at the top of our Facebook page right now, Animal Voices Vancouver. You can also search DogWab, D-O-G-W-A-B.
All right. If you have an animal-friendly event that you'd like to have announced on the show, please send us an email at info@animalvoices.org or post it to our Facebook page at Animal Voices Vancouver. And I think we have time for just a quick bit of news here. So last weekend was the BAFTA Awards in the UK, the British Academy Film and Television Awards. Yes, BAFTA. And the winner of the Best Short Film category was a film called 73 Cows. So this film is about a vegan farmer who gave, it's about a farmer who went vegan and gave his cattle to an animal sanctuary to save them from slaughter. So Jay Wild is the name of the farmer. It's a beautiful story.
I love stories like that. There seems to be more and more of them, and I think I've even posted one on our Facebook page for later today if you want to check that out.
Yeah, for sure. There's actually a whole website now. There are so many farmers, beef and dairy animal farmers, who are going vegan that the group called Free From Harm, they have started a whole section on their website to just telling the stories of all these animal farmers who decided to go with empathy and went vegan and have changed their businesses and so that's good stuff. You can find that on their website, freefromharm.org, and look for the Sowing Change section.
Well, thank you for that news, Sinead.
For our feature interview today, we welcome back vegan luminary Dr. Will Tuttle. Dr. Tuttle is an award-winning speaker, educator, author, and musician. His music, writings, and presentations focus on compassion, intuition, meditation, social justice, and creativity. Perhaps best known for writing The World Peace Diet, one of the most important books of the 21st century, Dr. Tuttle is here today to speak about his newest book called Buddhism and Veganism, Essays Connecting Spiritual Awakening and Animal Liberation. This book is a collection of teachings and stories by people who are committed to both Buddhism and veganism and who share a variety of insightful perspectives on how spiritual awakening and animal liberation interconnect and reinforce each other. Dr. Tuttle has been vegan for the last 39 years himself and is a former Zen Buddhist monk. Hello, Dr. Tuttle, and welcome back to Animal Voices.
Thank you, Allison, and welcome everyone. I'm glad to be here. Thanks for listening.
Well, thank you for coming on the show today to speak to us about the religion of Buddhism and its strong interconnections with the tenets of veganism. I learned a lot from reading this book and reflecting how the core teachings of Buddhism actually intersect with my own beliefs held by veganism. Now, Buddhism is the fourth largest religion on earth with over 360 million followers and even up to an estimated 1 billion followers worldwide. For those of our listeners who don't know anything about this faith, can you start by telling us a bit about the history of the Buddhist religion and then how it came into your own life?
Sure. Yeah, Buddhism is an ancient tradition, as everyone knows. It goes back 2,500 years, so it's older than Christianity by about 500 years. And the fundamental teaching, it came out of India. I would say the fundamental teaching is ahimsa, or nonviolence. And of course, Buddha, the Sanskrit root B-O-D-H, Bodh or Bud, means to wake up. So the basic idea in Buddhism is that it is possible for human beings to wake up, to awaken out of the delusion of being a fundamentally separate self, and to realize that what we are essentially is not merely a conglomeration of a physical body with mind and feelings and sense impressions and so forth. They try not to define it, but the idea of eternal consciousness, essentially. But this is something that cannot be understood intellectually, but can only be awakened to by questioning the narrative, essentially, of our own mind and of our society, and discovering our true nature. It emphasizes life as an adventure of discovery, to discover our true nature and then also to live it. And the basic idea, when we discover our true nature, we see that we're not essentially separate from other expressions of life, not only human beings, but also animals. So foundational to Buddhism, compassion for all living beings. Buddhism sees all expressions of life all sentient beings as worthy of moral consideration because they're sentient and they can suffer, so therefore we should not cause them suffering. So that's at the very core of the Buddhist teaching.
And how did Buddhism come into your life for you? You have an interesting story about that.
Well, for me, you know, I was eating usual meals, lots of meat, dairy products and eggs, and also going to church. I was Episcopalian, and then I played the piano and the organ. I became a church organist, actually, when I was in high school, so I went to church to play the organ. But later, when I was in college, I started questioning a lot of things because of the Vietnam War. This was in the early 1970s. And so I started protesting, but I also started questioning the underlying story, really, this is what I would say, of our society. And I became interested in a little bit in yoga and a little bit in meditation. And then I left home with my brother right after college. I was going to college in Vermont, and we thought we would walk to California. And we ended up walking basically to about Buffalo, and then from there heading south through upstate New York and down through Pennsylvania and Kentucky and Tennessee. But on the way, we stopped at a community called The Farm, basically the largest hippie commune in the world. It was also a vegetarian. It was actually a vegan community, pretty large, almost 1,000 people, mostly from San Francisco. They were living in a communal setting, growing their own food south of Nashville, Tennessee. And so I became a vegetarian because of that. And they were also inspired by the Zen Buddhist tradition. One of the main leaders of The Farm was a man named Stephen. And he considered Suzuki Roshi of the San Francisco Zen Center to be his kind of spiritual teacher. So I didn't realize it, but essentially I became a vegetarian. And then a few years later, a vegan. I was inspired by The Farm, but The Farm was inspired by Buddhism. And that's one of the things I've noticed over the years. I talk in the new book, Buddhism and Veganism, about how, in many ways, Buddhism is the hidden thread in the vegan movement, or one of the main hidden threads, because a lot of people go vegan and they're influenced by a book or a teaching. And if you trace it back to that person, the person who wrote it and the person who inspired them. And so that's one of the main inspirations, I think, behind everything really was Buddhism. And also, I have to say, Jainism. They both emerged about the same time, around 500 BC, and both have a strong ahimsa message. Buddhism is more well known, I would say, in the culture today, but they're both, I think, were very influential to go vegetarian and led, in many ways, I think, probably laid the groundwork for the whole vegetarian movement in many ways, perhaps, with Pythagoras and the movement that came later.
So I'd like to talk about the underlying relationship between Buddhism and veganism from the book, which consists of a collection of thoughtful essays from many practicing Buddhists. I've learned some of the foundational teachings that Buddhism offers in our relationship with the world and in all of its inhabitants, including the non-human animals. You were speaking a little bit about this earlier. The Buddhist teachings honor what are called the five precepts. Can you tell us about these five precepts, please?
Sure, yeah. The five precepts are the five ethical agreements, basically, and we try to live up to them, and to not steal, to not lie, thieve, to not commit sexual misconduct or sexual abuse, and to not take drugs or alcohol or cause others to take drugs or alcohol against their will. And these are really, I would say, five universal, probably the five primary universal taboos in all cultures. If we kill another or deceive them or steal from them or sexually abuse them, or in Buddhism, they're considered the five ethical teachings. And the whole point, though, of course, is that they are to be applied in our relationships, not just with human beings, but with all living beings. And animal agriculture is a complete, we kill them, we deceive them, we steal from them, we sexually abuse them, we force drugs on them. So, you know, eating animal foods is completely off the table if you're practicing Buddhist, from my point of view.
Well, as part of my own vegan beliefs, I have long considered myself to follow the tenet of ahimsa, which means non-harmfulness or to do the least harm in my own daily life. I've always known this has been something that comes from Buddhism, but for me, I just feel like it comes from within in myself. And this is something that has long resonated with me as an obligatory way to conduct myself as a human being. I believe this is a strong foundation on which veganism is built, always trying to do the least harm. And this is actually the foundation of the five precepts in the Buddhist faith. Can you talk to us more about ahimsa and how it not only applies to the faith of Buddhism, but should actually be a core belief that every human being should follow, I think?
Right. Yeah, that's very well said. I think ahimsa is the essential teaching of veganism. I think veganism is another way of saying ahimsa. It's basically trying to minimize the violence that we're causing to others, the five precepts, in regards to other human beings and to animals. And it's the foundational teaching, really, I think, in virtually all the world religions, because there is some version in many ways of what is referred to as the golden rule in Confucianism, Taoism, Buddhism, most forms of Hinduism, as well as Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. The idea of not doing to others what we wouldn't want to have done to ourselves, which is we don't want to be deceived and lied to, stolen from, and killed, and so forth, abused. So it's just basically this is our own true nature shining, but the whole problem is that we're born into a culture where we're unfortunately wounded by being forced to participate in these mealtime rituals, where we learn to just create categories, where we put beings into certain categories where we can do that to them and it doesn't matter. You know, cows, pigs, chickens, turkeys, ducks, geese, fishes, these animals, we just put them into the category where we can lie, steal, kill, sexually abuse them, drug them. And it doesn't matter because they were given by God to us to eat or whatever the story is. Whereas in Buddhism, you're not allowed to do that. In a sense, I mean, the teachings in Buddhism are very clear that all sentient beings are, that they're all relevant. And so we should do the best we can to minimize our violence to all beings. And that's really the foundation of happiness, really, for ourselves as well, which is an important point.
You are listening to Animal Voices on Vancouver's Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM, CFRO. 100% listener-sponsored radio, broadcasting live from the east side on unceded Coast Salish territories.
There is even more in the teachings of Buddhism that resonates with me as a vegan who has only just learned so much about this religion a few days ago from reading the book. I'd like to talk about the Four Noble Truths. Can you tell us about these truths and how they also shed light on the vegan way of living and towards a future path that experiences enlightenment?
Well, yeah, the Four Noble Truths are the foundational teaching in Buddhism, and the first of the Four Noble Truths is the teaching of dukkha, which means suffering, or I think a better translation probably is the English language word unsatisfactoriness. So this is kind of the basic foundation that essentially we can't avoid this basic unsatisfactoriness of life as long as we don't understand our true nature. And this unsatisfactoriness is that we just don't get what we want, that we can get sick, we're going to grow old, we're going to die, we're going to lose everything. What we want to get, we don't get. What we wish we didn't get, we end up getting. This is really unavoidable. And so that's the first noble truth, is to just see that clearly and understand that. The second noble truth is the cause of this unsatisfactoriness, and that basically is delusion, that we don't understand clearly who we are, what life actually is. And the third noble truth is where it starts to get positive, essentially. And the third noble truth is that it is possible to awaken out of the delusion, that we can heal, essentially, the wounds that are causing all this suffering. The suffering is unavoidable if we don't awaken out of the delusion, but the third noble truth says that there is a possibility of putting an end to the cause of our suffering, which is delusion. And then the fourth noble truth is the Noble Eightfold Path. It's referred to. The Eightfold Path is the way that we actually do this. And the Noble Eightfold Path is, I think, is a really quite a beautiful teaching. The first of the Eightfold Path right understanding. And it's so interesting because in a way that's the very hardest thing, and it's the first thing on the list. To get right understanding takes many, many years. But basically the idea is that if we cultivate right understanding, we let go of the delusion that what I am is a separate self and I have to get what I want, and begin to see in a bigger picture the interconnectedness of all expressions of life. There's also various forms of right action that are required, right effort, right mindfulness, right livelihood, and this is how we live our life. So the whole idea is to live our life in alignment with the quest of awakening, but the final several paths of the Noble Eightfold Path are right meditation and right contemplation. This is where the emphasis is placed on calming the mind, attaining what in actually the Sanskrit word is samadhi, which means a mind which is at peace, where we're not just churning up thoughts all the time. My old Zen teacher said, our mind is like a popcorn popping machine and we can't find the off switch. And, you know, that's kind of, and so those thoughts are just always arising, and they're driven pretty much by our past programming, by what our father, our mother, our school teacher, the minister, the ads on TV, you know, all this input, you know, and so we're being propelled along in our lives by our mind, and our mind is driving all these emotions and all these goals and wishes that we want to have and reactions. And so in many ways, we're just at the mercy of past events that we've reacted to and the wounds that we've internalized. And so it's not possible to actually be at peace as long as we don't understand our mind and begin to tame and train our mind. So that's why I think these latter steps on the Eightfold Path are very particularly important for vegans, because it's a great wisdom teaching. I think we understand the middle part of the Eightfold Path, which is living our life, you know, having right action, not buying meat products and eggs, not working in a job where I'm harming animals, you know, living these teachings. That's very important. I think what the gift that Buddhism brings to the vegan movement is the importance of meditation, contemplation, stability, internal quiescence of mind, so that we have a luminous consciousness that's not just covered over by all the reactions that we have, and we're fighting with other people, with other vegans, and so forth, and to really work every day. Every day I wake up in the morning, and I always meditate for an hour at the very beginning, and just watch my thoughts and feelings, and become aware, like become the witness, in a sense, of what's happening, rather than be the actor and get upset about somebody, say, oh, I can be aware that I'm getting upset. You know, then I'm not upset, really. I mean, if we can watch this and we can see it's just a reaction that has a beginning in old wounds, then we're liberated from the pain of these things, and we can begin to really be a force for love in the world. And that's really, I think, what veganism is. When it comes right down to it, it's nonviolence or ahimsa. Now, that's stating it sort of negatively, nonviolence. But on the positive term, it's loving kindness or compassion or mercy, tenderness, gentleness, loving kindness. And so that's really the essence of the teaching, really, of all the great spiritual traditions. And to actually live this requires us to live it in the outer world, which is what veganism is about, but also do the inner work to heal the inner wounds and untangle the inner knots, so that our mind and our body and our actions and our affairs are all congruent. That when we speak, our body language and our words and our tone of voice and everything all goes together, because we're living this at a deep level. And I think we become much more effective as advocates this way. And I think our movement will really mature when we begin to understand these ideas and live them more as a movement.
Well, I've been practicing meditation quite a lot these days myself, and I've been learning about mindfulness, as you're speaking about. I see this practice as being very much in alignment to what I want to achieve as a vegan and a mindful person. Now, in your book, it says, like Buddhism, veganism is best seen as the ongoing practice of awakening, not as a goal or state of being, but rather a continual evolution. I'm wondering if you can speak a bit more about meditation and mindfulness and how it works for someone who is on a continual path of learning, as I believe we all are?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think essentially mindfulness is awareness, and that's the foundation for veganism, because if we're not mindful, we'll just eat a hamburger or a hot dog or cheese, and that's what we're eating. We don't think deeper. We don't feel into what we're doing. We're not really mindful. But as soon as we become mindful, we look at what we're eating, and that's usually when a vegan is born, right? They go, this is a cow, right? This is from an egg, from suffering. So this mindfulness really gives us a fresh way of perceiving. We begin to look more deeply, feel more deeply, connect more deeply. And that's why I think they have a regular practice of mindfulness to every day. For example, myself, I wake up in the morning and do some various exercises in Tai Chi. But right in the very beginning, I always spend an hour just sitting and watching my breath and watching my mind and being aware. And I think taking time every day to do that, and taking time also to do retreats, perhaps, where we do this for 8 or 10 hours a day for a week or two, or you know, these kinds of things can be very helpful, because we're raised in a society where we're trained to never do that, to just sort of be hammered, you know, by external obligations and by all our thoughts and feelings, and they just overwhelm us. And so a regular daily practice where we become the witness, we watch what's happening, instead of being affected by it directly, we can witness these thoughts and feelings arising. Then they don't grab us like fish hooks, stabbing our flesh and tearing us and making us, oh, he said this and she did that, and now, you know, we get all upset. And then we become, I think, much more effective as advocates too.
Yeah, I wholly agree with that. So while many of our listeners, they may not identify completely yet with the vegan ethic, hopefully they're learning, but perhaps they identify as belonging to one of the major groups of religion in the world, such as Christianity, Judaism, or Islam. And you spoke a bit about this before, but I'm wondering if you can expand on if you think that the core principles of Buddhism align with those of other major religions, and can you identify any common ground between Buddhism and other religions as they relate to compassionate living and the non-harming of others?
Yes, I think that's a very good point you're making. And I used to teach college courses in comparative religion, and I always loved doing that, because I found when we go deeply into, for example, three Abrahamic traditions, which are the ones that are sort of formed the West, Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, there is definitely an underlying message of not doing to others what we wouldn't want to have done to us, or ahimsa. That's basically the ahimsa teaching. It's there. It's just, the problem is with those religions, they were essentially molded by a herding traditions. There's lots of teachings within those traditions that give us the excuse to kill and eat animals, various passages in the scriptures, and then also just the practice of human beings that are in those traditions. Whereas these other traditions, for example, Taoism, Buddhism, Confucianism, many of the traditions within Hinduism, they did not come so much from such strong herding traditions, so their ethical teachings are much clearer. So to remember that in these traditions from Asia, there is no deity at all. There's no God that has any kind of judgmental or creative power, anything like that. These are more systems that are ethical systems based on understanding our right relationship with each other, and they're spiritual traditions of awakening, but they're not based on any particular concept of a deity. And they are much more, I would say, friendly toward veganism, and in the sense that animals are typically included within the realm of being valid subjects of compassion.
Excellent. Well, I think that hopefully people in other religions can find the common ground that is taught in, say, Buddhist teachings and then veganism, and see that we're maybe really more alike than different. And I think there's some bridges that can be joined there. And I would like to see that. And you actually go to a lot of churches like all around the world and speak, and I'm sure you're not just speaking at Buddhist places. Can you tell us a bit about how that experience has been and how it's been received by, say, you're speaking at a Christian church of some sort?
Right. Well, actually, the basic teachings are very similar, and I can speak at a church that's oriented toward Christianity or Buddhist, for example, or Jewish, or whatever, synagogue. The underlying teachings are very similar, and I emphasize the common bond that we have. And many of the world's religions are non-exclusivist. You know, there's not this idea that, well, if I'm a Christian, I can't also be a Buddhist. You know, Buddhists don't have that idea. You know, if you want to be a Buddhist, you also want to be some other Hindu or Christian. It's not a conflict, and there's no inherent conflict there. So I think it's just important, I think, at least for me, it's been very helpful to study the other religions, to read the scriptures, and to see the wisdom in them, and to see that this is part of our human heritage. As human beings, we have access to these, and there's a tremendous gold mine of brilliant, inspiring wisdom in all these different traditions. And I found especially, you know, Asian traditions, indigenous traditions can be very, very helpful, as well as a lot of what's in our own traditions. A lot of that's been covered up. But the underlying message is to do the best we can to live the deep teaching of whatever spiritual path or religion we're drawn to. And I think the underlying teaching and path is one of awakening to the interconnectedness of all life and to being a force for loving kindness and respect toward others rather than exploitation, oppression, and abuse of others. That not only makes a better world for everybody, it brings more happiness and freedom and joy to ourselves and also to everyone else. We're all interconnected, that basic teaching.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, I'd like to talk about the culture that we have long cultivated that brings people to desire and crave meat. In the book, it says that the very thought of renouncing meat can produce an onslaught of unpleasant emotions, and I've seen this to be true in many, many people. People love their meat. Can you speak about the history of our meat-loving culture in the world and the karmic consequences of eating meat?
Yes, I think there's a certain addictive quality to animal foods in general, especially dairy products, but in general. But also, at a deeper level, we mold our identity around whatever food we're eating. So as little kids, we're raised in a society where our parents, from the time we're little infants, are giving us, if you even look at the baby food jars, there's already turkey and veal and chicken and beef and cheese. So we're eating these foods from the time we eat anything. And that's at a very deep archetypal level. That comes nurturance and love and acceptance and survival, you know, those foods. And then as we grow up, of course, the holidays, all holidays are based around feasts and food. So so there's this deep tribal connection we have through food with the people in our lives. And so as soon as someone says they're a vegan, all kinds of alarm bells go off in everybody else's minds because they think, well, they're not part of my tribe anymore. They're some other sort of dangerous person because they're questioning my beliefs, my understanding. So I think this is where a lot of the alarm bells go off that you're talking about when people try to give up meat. You're not just giving up meat. We're giving up a whole series of attitudes and identities about who we are and our relationship to animals, our relationships, you know, between men and women, because, again, animal agriculture is really based on males dominating females, humans dominating animals. You know, these are hardwired into the food. And so veganism is about questioning all of these at the deepest level, actually. And that's challenging for most people who haven't done the inner work. That's, again, why mindfulness and inner work are so helpful, because we can begin to see that as we move toward a more compassionate and aware way of eating and living, we just become much happier. we just begin to feel much more loving, and we feel much healthier, of course. The foods are much less toxic. And it's like giving up cigarettes or giving up alcohol. You know, it's a struggle. And the and people say, oh, my body, you know, my body wants to crave. You know, your body will crave tobacco, too. You know, it doesn't mean it's a good idea to eat to smoke. It doesn't mean it's a good idea to use these toxic substances. It's the same thing with animal-based foods. There will be a period maybe where it's difficult to give, quote unquote, give it up. Our body may want it, our mind or our relationships with people, you know, we may feel left out. The church has a barbecue and, you know, we can't go, or we can go, but they don't have any food for us, you know, that kind of thing. So there's a lot of overtones, and as everyone who's a vegan knows. And I think the beautiful thing to understand is that we are supported in every religion by the core teachings of that religion to be vegan.
Yes, I agree. Yeah. Well, the Buddhist teachings emphasize cultivating the two fundamental powers in our human world, the power of the individual and that of community. We've spoken some about the power of the individual, but can you tell us about the power of community and the power of this to rise up for the good of humankind?
Yes. Well, what we're doing right now, I think, Allison, this is an example of the power of community. You know, we can create online communities or radio communities or VegFest temporary communities or vegan restaurant communities. The whole idea is that the only reason anyone eats animal foods really is because of the communities that we've been raised in. So as individuals, even though, like you say, we have the power to choose what we're going to do and eat and so forth, we're so influenced by our communities. And so because of that, we're doing things that are not in our best interest. So I think people know that deep down. That's why there's so much, I think, cognitive dissonance in people. They know deep down, and even halfway down, that eating animal foods is not good for their health, definitely bad for the environment, terrible for the poor animals, bad for wildlife, causes starvation and hunger. You know, it's just such a hideous practice. And on every level, I mean, you could really say it's demonic, for sure, at the core level. But because we've been molded and hypnotized and conditioned by the communities we've been raised in, we become basically robotic in our behavior. We're just doing what we've been told because it's been injected into us relentlessly from infancy, over and over again, three times a day, in the most powerful way possible. So it's very difficult to break out of, you know, that kind of indoctrination. But so that's why having alternative communities that are based on sanity and compassion and sustainability and liberation and so forth like this show that you have, any kind of community that we can create. Like I say, like the farm was a community like that. The Zen Buddhist monastery in South Korea where I lived that had been vegan for like 800 years. That was another example of a vegan community. Or any kind of, you know, a YouTube channel that's promoting veganism as a vegan community. We can create all kinds of communities. Those communities help people to see there's other types of communities that we can evolve into and that we can support. And then I think essentially the whole idea right now on this planet is that we human beings wake up, take these ancient wisdom teachings to heart, and put them into practice, because if we don't do it in the next 10, 20 years, we probably won't even have a planet for our children to live on. So this is not just these aren't just abstract ideas you and I are talking about. This is really extremely important for each one of us to do the best we can to understand and to live in our daily lives.
Just for those of our listeners who didn't understand what you meant by we not might have a planet to live on in 20 years, this is your chance to give them a little bit of education about that.
Sure. Well, you know, I think many scientists are already ringing the alarm bells. There's been just, you know, recent research done that the rate of the loss of genetic diversity, the number of species we're dropping into extinction because of animal agriculture, because we're cutting down rainforest right now at the rate of over an acre per second. These are the lungs of the earth, and they're also where most of the variety of life lives, and also oceans are being completely devastated as well, that by the year 2026, we will have lost most of the genetic diversity, most of the mammals, many of the birds will be completely extinct. We're talking about a massive extinction that we're in the middle of right now, the largest extinction of species in 65 million years. And with the other changes that are happening, the soil erosion, water pollution, water depletion, ocean destruction, climate destabilization, we cannot no longer do animal agriculture because it is the driving force behind the environmental devastation. And also, as I talk about in the World Peace Diet, the food shortages are causing mass migrations and conflicts, wars. We have nuclear weapons. You know, we can't be eating animal foods, which are foods of violence and abuse, you know, and a whole war against nature with the technology that we have and ever expect to survive much longer. And I think this is becoming really obvious. So I think those of us who are vegans or are interested in these ideas can really help more than anyone to bring light and healing to the situation and help our society transition to our true nature, really, as human beings, which is not eating animals. Nobody, as a little kid, wants to strangle and kill and eat squirrels or rabbits or something. This is not our true nature, to be killing animals. But we're forced into this violent behavior without our permission. And then the attitudes go into everything, and the attitude of the domination of the sacred feminine dimension of life, which is really one of the cores of all religions, is a sacred feminine. And that's been repressed because of animal agriculture as well. So we have these kind of pseudo-religions based on promoting patriarchy and war. That's not the true message of religion.
Well, finally, I think that everything that we've talked about today, the commonalities between the tenets of Buddhism and those of veganism, they can also apply, as we've seen, to anyone who wants to live an authentic life, which encourages both respect and kindness to all individuals and in our communities. What are your final words that you would like to impart to our listeners who can find truth in the cultivation of awareness and integral values that we've spoken about today, and what are the next steps to apply that we can take from this talk today, whether you are a Buddhist or not?
Thank you. Yeah, I think essentially this has been a wonderful opportunity to share the ideas. I feel very happy and fulfilled that I was able to say some of the main points that are in the new book, Buddhism and Veganism, which I really highly recommend if anyone is interested in the deeper aspect of either Buddhism or veganism. I think it's a good resource for helping to understand these ideas and then live them more deeply. But essentially, the main point I would just end with here is the importance of seeing the connection between the inner and the outer, between our outer practice of kindness and compassion as best we can, and the inner practice of questioning the inner narratives, the inner stories that we have about our relationship with animals, with each other, the goals that we have, our ambitions, how we conceive success to be, for example. We're only on this earth for a few years, really. Do we spend our years just trying to consume more, trying to keep up appearances, or do we do what the spiritual teachers have always encouraged us to do, which is to find out our true nature? Who are we? What are we actually? And I think the beautiful thing I've discovered is if I go as deeply as I can into that question, it opens doorways that open more doorways, and I begin to get a glimpse that what I am is far greater than this little physical material object that I've been taught I am, that needs to get what I want and keep away what I don't want, which leads to endless suffering. So the inner work of meditation, the outer work of vegan living support each other and help us, I think, to evolve as individuals and as a society. And I think if we can spend the, whatever it is, 8 or 9 decades, if we get that many, whatever it is, of our time on this earth, contributing to the healing of our world by working on ourselves and also doing like you're doing to help create vegan community, then we've lived our life really well. And I think that's the beautiful thing. We can all live our life, our own unique life. And the only way to do that is to do the inner listening and live in the outer way, a vegan, compassionate way, and it just gets better and better. I mean, I've been a vegan now for 39 years, and I can just say the food gets better, the relationships get better, and life gets better. It's just it's the greatest gift we can give to ourselves. That's the great irony. You know, people people think that, I don't want to go vegan. I don't want to give up something. I mean, you can't do anything more of a great gift to yourself than compassion for others. It's the most wonderful thing we can do for our own happiness. And that's really what the world of spiritual traditions have emphasized. So I think it's just great that I think the vegan movement is maturing and we're beginning to understand that this is a transformational movement that we can all participate in and work on ourselves as well.
Well, thank you, Dr. Will Tuttle, for coming on the show today to speak about the subject of Buddhism and veganism. The new book, edited by Dr. Tuttle, is entitled Buddhism and Veganism, Essays Connecting Spiritual Awakening and Animal Liberation, and it comes out on February 24th. You can pre-order it on Amazon right now. To find out more about Dr. Tuttle's extensive work in vegan advocacy via writing, speaking, music, and more, you can visit his website, willtuttle.com. Thank you so much for the interview today. I know you're traveling and on the road, so have a safe journey for the rest of your trip.
Thank you so much, Allison. Thank you, everyone, and bless you all. Thank you.
You have been listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM, CFRO, Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada, unceded Coast Salish territories. Please join us on our next show, Friday, February 22nd. And Carol, can you tell us what's going to happen then?
Yeah, well, as you know, even though we're covered with snow still, it's almost time to start looking at those little veggie gardens out there. So next week we have Farmer Stevie from Blueberry Farm in Duncan. It's called Brightside Blueberries. And he's going to be talking to us about how to do veganic gardening.
Wonderful. That sounds fascinating. So, that's next week, Friday, February 22nd. We here at Animal Voices want to connect with you online. Animalvoices.org is where you can stream shows or download the shows as podcasts, read our show blog with detailed links, and subscribe via iTunes or on Google Play. Stay in touch with us via our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. You can also send us your suggestions and comments about the show, either on Facebook or via email at info@animalvoices.org. To end the show today, we're playing a song called To Be Free by our guest on the show today, Will Tuttle himself. Stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening to Animal Voices today, and remember to be kind to the animals.